Okay, we're back with Colonel Bear, MBECD, and as I recall, we were in Korea.
Yes, I was talking about the Armistice Commission, which was set up after the armistice was signed. And this was very interesting that I had been sent down there as the Canadian representative. I used to be able to sit in and listen to all the discussions going on between the North Vietnamese, the South Vietnamese. I'm sorry, the North Koreans and the South Koreans, and the Americans on one side and the Chinese on the other. And they established this meeting place at Panmunjom, which is right on the border between North Korea and South Korea. And one side of the building was North Korea and the other side of the building was South Korea, literally. And the dividing line was there and never cross it. But to sit in as an observer and listen to some of these discussions, in the early days, I found most enlightening. And some of the subjects they were discussing were pretty serious things, but many of them were mundane subjects that, you know, they're just arguing about for the sake of arguing. So it was hard for us to understand why they were wasting time, these silly things.
So can you recall any of these
Oh,
mundane?
little border incidents, you know, some Allied soldier crossed the demarcation line and went 20 feet inside the North Korean zone, and he had no right being there, and explained to me why he went so far, and then you've got to investigate and find out who it was and why he did it or how it happened and go back the next day and explain it all. Very time consuming, and I thought in those days anyway, a waste of time. But the North Koreans and the Chinese had their points, and they had their reasons for doing this sort of thing. But a lot of the time was taken up with border incidents or demarcation line incidents, that sort of thing.
Were the Chinese doing the talking, or was it the North
No,
Koreans?
both. No, they were both talking. Oh, yeah. The same as the South Koreans and the Americans were talking. In my appointment at the Armistice Commission, I was really working in effect, in one respect, for the Canadian ambassador in Tokyo. And once a month I had to fly to Tokyo and go into the embassy and sit down and brief him on what had gone on at the Armistice Commission over the past 30 days or so. And this was interesting. He gave me a very nice break in Tokyo for a couple of days. And I became very friendly with a Canadian colonel there who was on the staff at the embassy and his family. And every time I went over, they had me out to their place for dinner, and it was a great break.
I'm interested, Colonel, why an artillery officer would be assigned such a function.
Well, it's a staff appointment. It's got nothing to do with artillery. My job was to observe what went on and to report to, well, not only the Canadian ambassador in Tokyo, but also to the Canadian brigade commander in Korea, what was going on. And this was General Allard in those days, and I had to brief him as well. It had nothing to do with artillery. The appointment could have been filled by any officer from any corps.
I see.
Doesn't matter. It's just it's a staff job.
But you found it quite an insight, I'm sure.
Quite interesting. I was only there about six, 7 months, I guess, before I was sent home. My tour was up. In fact, I was over my 12 months. I'd spent 15 months in Korea. But I enjoyed it. It was fun. And occasionally I'd get back to my old regiment up in the forward area and spend a night with them, relax. The next thing that happened to me was I got word that I was being sent home in May of 54. That's right. And I was simply to stop off and pick up my family in Ottawa and go straight on to the United Kingdom, where my next posting was. And I was seconded to the British Army. And I was working in London in their so-called War Office, which is the equivalent of our Army headquarters and National Defense headquarters, as a staff officer in the Director of Royal Artillery's office. And in those days, and they still have, of course, we have these exchange positions where British officers come over here and are fitted into the Canadian Army or Armed Forces and fulfill a staff appointment or an instructor in gunnery appointment or something like that. They're still British, but they're working for Canadians. Well, I went over there and worked as a Canadian for the British. And I worked over there for 3.5 years in London. I lived in Guildford, which is where my wife was from originally. And I used to commute up and down on the train every day to London, and walk across the Thames, Hungerford Bridge, and into the War Office. And I thoroughly enjoyed this. It was a change of pace, and I thought great fun. I was still a major. The Suez Crisis happened when I was working for the British, and this was when France and UK decided they had to go into Egypt. And as a Canadian working for the British, we felt that I wasn't the only Canadian at the War Office, there were lots of us. We felt that we were in a pretty precarious position. And the Canadian government at that time sent out letters to all of us saying, now, although you're working for the British, you remember you are a Canadian, and Canada has decided not to get involved in this crisis, and therefore judge yourself accordingly. It was a funny position to be in.
Yes, I'm sure. Yeah, this was when Pearson was doing his end run around at the
United Nations. And I was personally involved because I was responsible for communications and vehicles for the Royal Artillery. And here were these British units being outfitted and brought up to strength, not only in personnel but equipment as well, to go into Egypt. And I was the guy who had to arrange for them. So I was quite involved, but nothing unusual came out of it, so all was well. Anyway, I had 3.5 years there, which was just great. My two daughters were with us, and they were very young, and they went to British schools, and quite enjoyed it. And eventually I was sent home to Canada in, 57. I went home, yeah. Went over in 54 and back in 57. That's right. And I was posted to Kingston, Ontario, the staff college, and this time I went there as a member of the directing staff on promotion to lieutenant colonel. So I was just another instructor at the staff college for the next, 3 years? No? Yes, 3 years, that's right. Yes, 3 years, 57 to 60, correct. And, well, that was something different too. You know, you go through the college as a student and you think you work hard, and you go back as a member of the faculty and you find you're working harder than the students. Because during the time I was there, Ottawa decided that they were going to run a 2-year course instead of a 1-year course. So the commandant at the time said, well, forget about all the exercises, all the praises, forget about everything we've had in the past. We've got 9 months off before the first 2-year course starts, and we'll sit down and we'll write everything right from scratch. Well, that's a terrible job. Well, not a terrible job, but a long, tedious job. I can remember working weekends with other instructors and spending weekends down at the college just writing, exercises and praises. But it was a rewarding job in that you'd get a student in on day one and you'd see him graduate a year later or 2 years later. And you'd feel you'd achieved something like any instructor does, I guess. Well, in fact, I was posted out of the college before the first 2-year course started, or it had just started but hadn't graduated, right? And from there I was sent to Indochina. And this was part of the Canadian Control Commission. And it was trying to oversee, a commission was made up of Indians, Asian Indians, who were supposed to be the neutral people, and Canadians from the Allied side and the Poles from the Communist side. And there were team sites throughout the North and South Vietnam, and we were trying to observe what goods were being brought into the two countries and what was going out, and keep control of this sort of thing and not allow arms shipments in and so on and so on. It was a funny business. It's in some ways like the Armistice Commission in Korea, and that there were lots of arguments and meetings and discussions and mundane matters, and nothing was achieved. But we knew the other side was raising these points just to make a name for themselves, or to make them think they were achieving something.
It must have been strange
Yeah.
Beating the Poles on the one side, and you only having fought through
That's
Valley
right.
and up through the Scheldt.
Yeah.
Previously.
And one might think that the Indians would automatically side with the Allied side, but not so. They were strictly neutral, and if they thought the Poles were on the right side of the argument, then they'd agree with the Poles, and we'd be outvoted 2-1. There was a Canadian commissioner out there, a civilian, and we worked for him. Now, I went out there in, what am I talking about, 1960, that's right. I went out at Easter time, 1960, for a year's tour. And when I arrived, I was sent out to one of these team sites with an Indian and a Pole, and the three of us worked together. And this was on a port called Natrang on the east coast, and we had to observe and watch and make sure everything was right. And I'd only been out there a month when I was called back to Saigon and told that I was no longer going to work for the Canadian delegation. I'd been seconded to the Indian delegation, and I was going to work in the Secretariat as the Deputy Secretary General for Operations, a great big title which wasn't that important. But this was another experience I had which I found most exciting. I was no longer working for the Canadian ambassador, I was working for the Indian chairman. And I became very friendly with an Indian officer, Lieutenant Colonel, by the name of Charles Joseph, who we used to I used to correspond with for many, many years, but I've lost track of him now. And he was a very fine officer, was never afraid to make a decision. And a lot of the Indians were afraid, but not Colonel Joseph. He would make a decision. And I enjoyed working there. In that country, in those days, and there was no fighting on, the Americans were not involved in fighting in those days. It was so hot that the hours of work were from about 6:30 in the morning or 7 o'clock in the morning till 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and then that was it for the day, because the afternoon heat was supposed to be too hot to work. So a friend of mine and I used to play golf every afternoon. I got my handicap way down, and this is the way to do it, by playing every day.
Where were you stationed in?
Right in Saigon.
In Saigon?
Yeah. Now called Ho Chi Minh City,
Ho Chi Minh City, yes.
Right. Well, I was supposed to be out there for a year, but I was called home suddenly at the end of 7 months. And in fact, I got home just before Christmas. And when I was on my way home attending cocktail parties, and there were lots of social parties on, which Indians, Poles, and Canadians always attended. The Poles were going around saying, oh, Colonel Beer got involved in that recce that was sent out when the ambassador was away on holidays, and he ordered the recce out, and it was contrary to what the Indian ambassador wanted, and he's being sent home because he's been a naughty boy. And they were spreading this story around at the cocktail parties, you see, and accusing me of this. And, I accepted it. I knew I had nothing to do with it. I was sent home because the CO of the 2nd Regiment Horse Artillery in Winnipeg had died of a heart attack, and they wanted me home to take over command.
Mm-hmm.
So I only spent 7 months out there, and then I went home. And my family was in Kingston, so I went home and went up to Ottawa and was briefed by the Director of Artillery. And arrived in Winnipeg on the 2nd of January in about 10 feet of snow and cold as hell. Quite a change from Saigon.
From Saigon, yeah.
Right. And I had command of that regiment for 4 years, 3 years in Winnipeg, and then we moved to Germany for 1 year. So I was very fortunate to get command for 4 years. Nowadays, nobody gets command for more than 2 years, maximum.
Is that policy or just...
Yeah, policy, because there's so many people deserving, and it's such a plum appointment that every 2 years they change people around. So, this was great. General Walsh was the general officer commanding Western Command, which my unit was part of in those days. But after 1 year, after I got out there, 1 year later, General Walsh was posted to Ottawa and became chief of the general staff. And my old friend General Rockingham came in and took over as GOC Western Command, so we renewed acquaintances. What can I tell you about that? Not very much. 3 years of training in Winnipeg, Shadow, Wainwright, and so on. Very large unit in those days. Had five batteries of artillery, had three field batteries, a medium battery, a locating battery, and I had an ROP flight, my own spotter aircraft, which was located out in Shiloh, 120 miles away. So it was a large unit,
mm-hmm.
and it was a great command, a great challenge, and if anybody says he doesn't enjoy commanding a unit, he's got to have holes in his head. And after 3 years, well, in fact, when I came back from Indochina, that regiment was in such bad shape, dissension and poorly trained officers, that the regiment was not allowed to fire live ammunition. That's how bad they were. And this is why I was brought back. They thought I was the right guy to try and sort it out. So I went out there, and 5 days after I arrived, General Walsh arrived from Edmonton, and he started complaining about this, that, and the other thing. Shortages in my quarter stores, not allowed to fire live ammunition. Quarter guard didn't know how to parade properly when he arrived, and he had lots of complaints. And I listened to him, and I knew most of them. And he said, what can I do to help you? And I said, not very much, sir. And he said, well, what do you want? Do you want any of your battery commanders changed? I said, no, some of them I don't even know, but I'm not going to change them at this stage. Let me find out how good, bad, or indifferent they are. And he said, you got no requests. And I said, one. And he said, what's that? And I said, well, my 2IC, I've known for a long time, and we're not great friends, and I think it'll be a clash of personalities, and I'd like him posted. And someone else put in. He said, who do you want? And I said, well, I'll take one of the battery commanders, Major so-and-so, if you like. He said, okay, that's fine. So within 3 weeks, the 2IC was posted out, and the battery commander took over.
Where'd you known the 2IC previously from?
Oh, my days in Shiloh, and off and on in various places, but primarily in Shiloh. And we just had different points of view, and we didn't agree on very much, and I knew it would be a waste of time if the two of us stayed together, so it was the right thing to do to have him move. Whether it fixed his career or not, I don't know. He never did get promoted. I don't think that was the real reason. There were other reasons, I think. Anyway, we went through a series of paces and tests and put on command post exercises, which the big wheels came down to the sea, and then out to Shiloh and do dry deployments, you know, no live firing, see if your drills are right, and we got through that. Finally, the brigade commander recommended that we be allowed to fire by batteries only, but not as a regiment. We fired by batteries, and we got through that, and then they gave us permission to fire as a regiment. We got through that. We went to Wainwright for the summer, and they put us through a five-day exercise, and poured rain every day for five solid days. Anyway, we got through that in great style, and we went on from there. It got sorted out.
So what have the problems been? I mean...
problems?
Yeah, prior to your arrival, there must have been something to put the men into those sort of depths.
It wasn't the men. There was dissension among the officers. Some of the officers weren't taking the job seriously enough. There was not enough discipline in the unit. There was no morale in the unit. The CO... refused to have any sports teams in the unit.
Sounds strange.
Didn't participate in the brigade track and field meet every summer. Didn't form a band, and he had all the instruments and uniforms available in the basement of his headquarters building, but I was shocked when I saw them. But didn't want a band, didn't form a trumpet band. So it was easy for me. I just walked in and said, we'll participate in all sports events, we'll form a band, and we'll do our basic command post exercises, and we'll get help from the School of Artillery, which I did. Was out in Shiloh, 120 miles away, help in the form of instructors. And we went on from there, and we built up morale, and it wasn't that difficult. Yeah. Anyway, our regiment was the next one to go to Germany, but when I took over, they said, well, it's doubtful, we'll see. If you get your regiment up to a reasonable standard, you'll go to Germany, but otherwise you won't. So we got up to a reasonable standard, and in fact, we got up to a hell of a good standard. And eventually they said, yes, your regiment will be the next to go to Germany. And then they said, but I don't know whether you're going or not. You will either come in 2 years or 4 years, one or the other. We haven't decided yet. Well, I hadn't been to Germany since the war was over, and lots of Canadians had, and I was dying to get back to Germany. So, eventually they decided I would take the regiment to Germany and keep it for 1 year after getting over there. And in fact, I hit my regiment 4 years, and the year after I got to Germany, and the year in Germany was terrific. The training you got was far superior to the training you got in Canada.
Why was that?
Oh, not bigger and better ranges, but you were part of a British divisional artillery. You were working with the British. You were working at divisional and corps level instead of regimental or brigade level. Oh, and the emphasis on quick alerts and quick response was much higher than training in Canada because you were in an operational theater.
And where were you stationed in Germany?
Well, near the Dortmund area, and I was in Hamer, H-E-M-E-R, in fact. The British are in there now. The Canadians, as you likely know, moved down south and joined up with the Canadian Air Force, and they're all in one general area down south now. But in those days, the Army was up north, part of the British Army. So it was a great year, a terrific year. And then I was told I was being posted to Paris to be a student at what they call the NATO Defense College, which is a 5.5 month course, and in those days located in Paris. And there you learned the real aim, simple aim of the college was to learn to work together with officers from other NATO nations, Greeks, Turks, Italians, Americans, British, you name it. And you work not as individuals, but as members of a syndicate or a team, and this is how you learn to work together. So that was a real 5.5 months holiday. You know, you had no troops to look after. After 4 years in command, it was quite a change. Nice rest, and it was a leisurely pace, and the social activities were great. And spring in Paris is terrific, and I was there from February, which year am I in now? February 65 to August 65. So it was a great, great period. Having finished that course, I was posted to SHAPE headquarters, Supreme Headquarters of Allied Forces in Europe, which was just outside Paris, posted there. And in fact, I went out one day to meet my boss, my new boss, who wasn't in the day I went out. But then I came back, and 5 days before the course ended, they changed the posting. And I wasn't staying in Paris at all. I was being sent back to Canada. And I was posted to something called a mobile planning group in Carp, Ontario, which is outside Ottawa. And I didn't know what on earth this was all about. What on earth was a mobile planning group? And this was the start of unification. But being out of the country, we didn't know what in the hell it was all about.
Paul Martin hadn't consulted you
right.
prior to...
And, so I sent all my heavy baggage and a dog we had in those days to a friend in care of a friend in Ottawa. And then they changed the posting again and made it Montreal. Same headquarters mobile command planning group, but now Montreal, not Carp, Ontario. So by this time my wife was getting a little browned off. And we had our two children over there as well. So eventually we went to Montreal. And this was the start of Headquarters Mobile Command, just outside Montreal. And what they didn't tell me when I was posted back to Canada was that I was being promoted and appointed Chief of Artillery, head of the Canadian Artillery. And it wasn't until I got back to Ottawa, got to Ottawa and went in to see General Allard for my briefing as to what my job was all about, then I met a fellow gunner officer in the corridor who congratulated me, said it was terrific, and I said, what are you talking about? And he said, oh, your promotion and appointment. And I hadn't been told a damn thing about it. Everybody else knew, but I didn't know. And it was true. General Allard confirmed it, that I was being promoted full colonel and appointed Chief of Artillery at Headquarters Mobile Command. So we moved down to the Montreal area and bought a house in St. Lambert, Quebec, just outside Montreal on the other side of the river. And I worked at Headquarters Mobile Command for 4 years as Chief of Artillery. And those were the early days of unification, and I think I was the sixth officer on the ground at Headquarters Mobile Command, which is still in existence and now quite a large headquarters. And those were trying days early on, trying to reorganize. You had Air Force officers and Naval officers all there as well, and trying to work with them, get along with them, and it was difficult.
What was your primary responsibility, bringing all these officers together? What were you?
Well, this was the, I wasn't, the command, Mobile Command, was commanded and still is by Lieutenant General. General Willard was the first one.
Mm-hmm.
He was replaced by General Anderson. But basically, Mobile Command was responsible for all the ground troops, or what we used to call the Army, the ground troops, fighting ground troops, and the tactical air support for the Canadian forces. Maritime Command in Halifax, for example, was responsible for the sea aspects, the old Navy. And as Chief of Artillery, I was responsible for all the artillery in Canada, including the militia artillery units. And well, it was a pretty demanding job. I had a staff of, there were 12 of us all told, that's right, 12 officers, right. Now they're working with six, and the Chief of Artillery has moved to Ottawa, not in Montreal anymore. So it was trying, to say the least. At the same time, I was appointed president of the mess committee, the officers' mess, and I'd never been on a mess committee before in my life. That's something I'd missed in my career. So this was a great way to get indoctrinated into mess activities, to be appointed the head boy, president of the mess committee, of a mess that had a lieutenant general in it, and many other generals as well.
And you would, what, coordinate social activities and
things? Yeah, I was responsible for all aspects of the mess, entertainment, social activities, everything, conferences and so on.
What, if I could just take you back
for
a little bit there, any thoughts on reunification as such of the forces?
Are you asking me if I have any thoughts on reunification?
Yeah.
Well, you're getting away from the track we were on, but I don't think we can go back to reunification, and this is only my own personal opinion, obviously. I think we've gone too far with unification now to go all the way back. I think we can go part way back. And I think in the last 5-6 years we have been going part way back. And I'll mention a few very small items which wouldn't mean much to you or any other civilian, but to a soldier it means a hell of a lot. If you take the artillery, the infantry, the armored corps, what we call the combat arms, they have always had a hell of a lot of tradition behind them. They've had their own, when they wear their uniform, they have their own artillery buttons, in my case. They used to wear on their shoulders Royal Canadian Artillery, not Canada, but be identified with your corps, Royal Canadian Artillery. And unification did away with that sort of thing. We went to a common button. Everybody wore the same button. Everybody wore Canada's on their shoulders, not infantry or armor or artillery or whatever. And, those aren't important things to most people, but to someone who's served many years in that sort of corps, in that type of corps, it is important, and it's all part of the morale of a unit or corps. Anyway, they're gradually going back to it, and artillery wear RCAs now, not Canada's, and the artillery have their own buttons, and so have the armor, and so have the infantry, and we're gradually going back to some of those things. And there are other things of that nature, small points, but you can go back to some of the things pre-unification, but I don't think you can afford to go all the way back. And although the new Minister of National Defense, Mr. McKinnon, has got a committee set up which is investigating the possibility or where we should go, revert back or stay where we are or somewhere in between, I'd be very surprised if the solution they come up with isn't somewhere in between. Go back as far as you can, but I don't think you can go all the way back.
I see. Okay.
I think when it was first started, unification, I think I believed in it, and that I was convinced that it would save money. And I'm sure that in some cases it did save money. For example, instead of having a supply system for the Army and a supply system for the Navy and another one for the Air Force, surely there's some way of combining the supply systems so that there's one supply system for all three elements. Now, that's one place where I think you should have been able to save money, and I'm convinced they must have saved money. They have, for example, for many years now, long before unification, they've had one medical corps, one dental corps that serves all three services. You find Army medical officers, Army dental officers on ships. And they have one Army medical corps, one Army dental corps, which has for many, many years now served all three elements. And that was sensible, I think. Why have doctors for all three services, three separate corps of doctors, eh?
Mm-hmm.
A naval medical service, an Army medical service, an air medical service, or dental. So I think there are some areas there where they could have saved money, and they must have saved money. But to try and, I think maybe they went too far. They tried to unify everything, and I think this was a mistake. I think they went far too far. I'll give you another example, which is something I've never agreed with. I mentioned when I was commanding a unit in Winnipeg, I had five batteries and an Aero P Troop, or flight, mm-hmm. out in Shiloh. And those aircraft and pilots were part and parcel of my regiment. They were not attached to me. They were artillery. They all wore artillery badges, and they were artillery pilots. And their job in life was primarily to observe, find enemy targets from the air, which is much easier than finding them from being flat on the ground, and engage them. With unification, because all airplanes are airplanes, so they should be part of the air element. So that the artillery lost them. Now, I personally fought the battle for 3 years, and I lost the battle. And now, when an artillery commanding officer wants an aircraft to go up and observe an area and engage targets, he's got to request the use of the aircraft from some air element
mm-hmm.
organization. He may or may not get them. He hasn't got them available just like that as I had. So that's an example where I think they went too far. Where were we?
Appointed head of the mess committee there.
Head of the mess committee, Mobile Command, yeah. I only did the job for a year, but it was in the first year of the organization of Mobile Command, so, you know, having the problem of the mess on my hands, as well as trying to organize an artillery cell and get my staff together, it was a very busy year. Well, then, after four, that was a great job in many ways, in that I would spend as much time as I could out visiting the artillery units. And this was regular force units in Canada, the regular force units in Germany. At that time we had an artillery battery in Cyprus, and I tried to get out to visit them, but I never made it. I did arrange it, but they were being sent home early, and they started home before I got out there, so I didn't see them. And then